delighted that you're here. We have a good number present. We appreciate the presence of everyone. We're continuing a study of a series that we call Our Battle with Worldliness. We have covered a number of areas wherein there is problems with worldliness, from gambling to dancing and drinking and the foul mouth, fornication, stealing, smoking, and in our last study we talked about pornography. We want to continue that study this morning and talk about sexually attractive dress. And I want to suggest to you that I carefully chose that title to depict the problem that we are describing in our study this morning. Perhaps the word immodesty sends different messages to different people. And therefore, one who may dress in a sexually attractive manner, whether they know it or not, thinks that she is not immodest. And so we may talk about immodesty, and it may send a different signal to different people, and consequently I carefully worded our study this morning, sexually attractive dress. It is possible that one could dress in a way so as to be sexually attractive. Evidence? Proverbs 7 in verse 10 speaks of the attire of a harlot. The Living Bible Paraphrase translates that she dressed seductively. That she dresses in a way that she seduces the man. In fact, being sexually attractive or being sexually attracted is not wrong. In fact, the Bible says in Proverbs 5 that a man is to rejoice in the wife of his youth, and that is in the context of showing a contrast with fornication and adulterous relationship, and instead of pursuing that relationship, pursue that kind of thing with your wife. Let her breast satisfy you at all times. Talking about the intimate relationship. Furthermore, 1 Corinthians 7 in verse 9 said, it is better to marry than to burn with desire, some translation says. So that talks about being attracted to one another in a sexual way. In fact, God made us that way. And it's a biblical subject, and so we talk about that. God made us that way and wired us that way to be sexually attracted and attractive. But being sexually attractive or attracted to anyone other than your marriage partner is absolutely wrong. And therein is the problem that we want to address. I want to ask you to give this study a fair and honorable hearing, if you will. Such studies as we're going to do this morning probably do more good than we often credit them. I, for one, am quite prone to think at times that no need to talk about modesty again or dress because you do that and there are people who continue to dress in the way that they do and always have. And we want to say sometimes that it doesn't do any good, but these studies do probably more good than we would credit them because it would be much worse if we didn't preach on such subjects as modesty. And then know for a fact, and you do too, that in many churches it is far worse in those places than it is in the church here. I do not expect that everyone will give acknowledgement 100% to everything we say this morning. Not everybody will accept everything 100%. That's true of any sermon. If it were on baptism, not everybody would accept everything that was said 100%. I'm more bothered by the fact that not all who do accept it as 100% will conform to the principles. That's true on any subject as well. Now, quite frequently, people who come and say, we needed that study, we need that lesson, and that was a study, and you're right on target, and yet they do not conform to the principles themselves. And so I simply ask that you give a fair and honest hearing to the study this morning, if you will. I'm going to say some things that I'm going to be speaking very plainly and bluntly. You're going to hear some things this morning that you'll say, I've heard that before. I've heard you say that before. I've heard you present that before. And you'll be right. But I think you'll also find that you're going to hear some things that when I get through, you'll say, you know what, I did not know that, and I've never had anybody to teach that to me before. Well, I think we're going to touch on a point or two that I think is missing in much of the material that is presented on modesty or our dress. And so we focus on sexually attractive dress. We must admit, all of us, that a great portion of today's clothing is sexually attractive. I'm talking about in the world, not among brethren. We'll come to that a little bit later. But I'm talking about in the world that much of the attire is sexually attractive. For example, you just go to the mall, you go to the store, go to Kroger, go anywhere in town, and you'll see the following kind of outfits. You'll see low-cut tops and short shorts, even in December. You'll see tight jeans, form-fitting outfits, short skirts, dresses or skirts with splits in them. You'll see young ladies wearing something that has a message written across her backside, all of which draws attention to the female body, and that is the design of that. That's its purpose. Furthermore, I want to suggest to you that Mary Quant said in her statement, she, by the way, designed the miniskirt. And her statement about the miniskirt was that mini clothes, that is M-I-N-I, brief attire, are symbolic of those women who want to seduce a man. And when she was asked, where's all this kind of thing headed? And she said in one word, sex. I'm trying to establish that much of the clothing of the day is sexually attractive. As far back as the 50s, Life magazine reported that short shorts were favored to Bermuda shorts because Bermuda shorts emphasize the least attractive part of the legs, the knee, and the calf. That was back before many of you were born, before I was born, in fact, that they were saying that clothing was sexually attractive, in the 50s even. And yet our culture thinks that's good. You remember Isaiah made the point in Isaiah 5 and verse 20, there are those who call evil good and good evil. Things that are evil, they say that's good. And things that are good, they call it evil. Think about abortion and capital punishment. You kill a child and that's good. She has her liberty. Women have her rights. And so here is evil that's being called good. And yet something that's good, capital punishment, the Bible defends, it's terrible. We have a mixed up culture. And so you see a lady or a woman who may wear some of these attire that we're talking about, and maybe some other woman of the world will say, girl, you look good in that. You just really look great. That dresses you, and it may not have much at the top. It may be very brief at the bottom, may be very tight, form-fitting, but you look good in that. And that tells us that they're calling good evil and evil good. Philippians 3 talks about those who glory in their shame. Things they ought to be ashamed of, they glory in. And some of the attire so does that. We would be greatly naive if we thought that our culture did not have an impact on us and doesn't rub off on us. If we think we can live in a society that doesn't somehow rub off on us, we are quite naive. If we think that is the case. Let's begin this morning by talking about some simple principles for dress. Let's just keep it simple and list some simple principles that govern our dress and how we dress ourselves. Let's begin with what I call divinely made clothing. People give great emphasis to clothing and the label that is on the clothing and who made it. You could have two garments that are almost identical, but because this one has a name brand, it'll sell better because people want to wear something made by, and you fill in the blank, some great designer. Well, the greatest designer of clothing that has ever been is God Himself, and He made some clothes. I don't know if you realize that or not, but God made some. He had man to make some as well, but there was a time when God made some clothes. So let's open our Bibles to Genesis chapter 3. Sometimes call this the first clothing, but I think a better description is divinely made clothing. When God made it, you know it's right. In Genesis chapter 3, you remember in chapter 2, God made man and then he made woman. And the text ends in chapter 2, and not in the very last, it was the last verse, verse 25. They were both naked and they were not ashamed. If you don't already have a marginal note written, you might write out to the side, if you're so disposed to write, that verse 25, the word naked there, means they were nude. That's how God made them. There's no shame at this point. They don't know anything about being ashamed about that. So in verse 7 of chapter 3, the text tells us that they came to realize, having partaken of the fruit, now that they knew good and evil, the text says, they knew they were naked. You might write a marginal note out to the side, still nude. But now they see some shame in that. So what they do, they made themselves covering, says verse 7 says. In your footnote may say aprons or something to that effect. Some translation will use the term apron. And verse 10 now says, having done that, that when God called for them, they said concerning themselves, I was naked. But now they have some clothes on, though. And what I want you to see was that they are naked in a relative sense. That is, there's some clothing on, but they've made an attempt to cover their body, and they sewed themselves these coverings, as the New King James worded that. What was that covering? Well, that covering was, according to Yacinus and Leupold and Kyle and Dalich and a host of other scholars, that was simply a girdle-like or loincloth type of garment that would cover tantamount to what you'd have in a pair of jogging shorts of the day. I mean, it covered that section of the body. But verse 10 now says they were still naked in a relative sense. Do they have some clothes on? They do, but they're still naked. By their own admission, they were. Well, let's go a little further in the context. God put some clothes on them, so let's go to verse 21. And in verse 21, the text says, here's where we get the idea that it was divinely made clothing, and for Adam and his wife, the Lord God made tunics of skin and clothed them, he says. Well, the Lord made these clothes. And what did God make? He made a tunic of skin and put it upon them. It is at this juncture that they are clothed and their nakedness is covered. They were nude here, their nakedness is not covered. They covered part of their body, but their nakedness is not covered. Their nakedness is now covered because God had clothed them. What is a tunic? A tunic was a garment that covered, listen to this carefully, from the shoulder to the knee. A tunic was a garment that covered from the shoulder to the knee. You say, how do you know? Well, that's what the word means. In the ISBE, that's International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, it just simply says that this was most nearly like our long shirt, that reaching below the knee always, and in case it was dressed for it was designed for dress occasion, it would reach almost to the ground. Later in the article, it would say that sometimes those were shorter, like our modern fella, but he said it would reach at least to the knee. So twice in the ISBE article, it suggests that a tunic would always at least come to the knee, and in many cases, it would go much further. Here are three other scholars here. Here is Gesenus and Harris and Brown, Driver, and Briggs. You've heard of those and heard preachers quote from those. Those are for the Hebrew, what Thayer and Vines and Liddell and Scott and others are to the Greek. And here's what they say. They say that it was generally worn with sleeves, coming down to the knees and rarely to the ankle. Sometimes to the ankle, but always to the knee was the idea of a tunic. Fred Wright, in his book, Manners and Customs of Bible Times or Bible Land, said the tunic, inappropriately translated coat, was a shirt that was worn next to the skin, was made of leather, hair-like, or hair cloth, wool, linen, and in modern times usually of cotton. The simplest form was worn without sleeves and reached to the knees and sometimes to the ankles. The well-to-do wore it with sleeves, extending to the ankles. Women as well as men wore it, even though there was a difference in the style, as he mentioned. But what do I learn from that? I learned from that when God put clothes on them, divinely made clothing went from the shoulder to the knee. Now let's draw some conclusions from that. That tells me that when man attempted to clothe himself, that God didn't think it was sufficient. If it was, why did God make them more clothes? And when God clothed them, He covered them from their shoulder to the knee. That'll harmonize with some things that we see a little bit later. Let's consider a second principle. Let's open our Bibles to the book of Leviticus, if you will, the 18th division. I want you to see that nakedness is not to be seen except by your mate. Nakedness is not to be seen except by your mate. Let's turn to Leviticus 18. In the Old Testament, uncovering the nakedness of someone other than your mate was strictly forbidden. Let's look at verses 6 and 7, Leviticus 18. Then he said, "None of you shall approach anyone who is of near kin to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord. The nakedness of your father, the nakedness of your mother, you shall not uncover. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. The nakedness of your father's wife, you shall not uncover. That is your father's nakedness." Now that verse, particularly verse 8, tells us what is meant by uncovering the nakedness. It is not only the exposing of the body, but exposing of the body in view of a relationship. And it's interesting that he words it, your father's wife is not your nakedness, that's your father's nakedness. He can see that nakedness, but not you. Here's what I learned. Listen to this carefully. That nakedness, anyone other than your mate, was prohibited. You know what that implies? That implies that the normal state of things is that for nakedness to be covered. If it is not to be seen by anyone else, the normal state of things from the beginning was God intended for nakedness to be covered, whatever nakedness is. And the Bible gives us some insight and doesn't leave us blind about that. We won't take the time to develop all of these passages, but it ought to go without saying that showing one's nakedness was always equated with shame. It was in Genesis 3, when they came to know they were naked, they were ashamed, and they attempted to clothe themselves. And that's why they made themselves aprons. Let's go to the end of the Bible in Revelation chapter 3, particularly 16 in verse 15 and 17 in verse 16, are all passages that equate nakedness with shamefulness. And I cite at the beginning of the book, that is Genesis, and at the end of the book, Revelation, and all in between are sandwich passages that equate nakedness, seeing nakedness, with that of shame. Now let's talk about nakedness for a moment. It is a Bible subject. The word naked can refer to a complete nude body. It can refer to a partially nude body. Thayer says that's what it can mean, unclad without clothing, and it can also mean ill-clad or in undergarments. The undergarments of the first century time were more like our long johns that covered much of the body, but it was an undergarment. Badly clad, Kittle says, not fully clothed. Liddell and Scott says lightly clad. Here's what I learned from that. The word nakedness tells me, as it's used in the Bible, that one can have some clothing on and at the same time still said to be naked. Let's go to an extreme case that nobody would, I think, in the present assembly would approve of. But let's just think for a moment of going to the beach or to the pool. And here's a woman there in a bikini and or several of them around, and you say to them, "All of you are naked." They probably would be offended and say, "We are not. We have clothes on." They're thinking that the word naked means complete nudity, but the Bible uses it in the sense and says this is shameful that you can have clothing on at the same time still be naked. Now, I want to drive this point home. And that is that exposing one's thigh is exposing one's nakedness. When one exposes that section of the body, and we don't mean by that you have to expose the whole thigh, but when any part of the thigh is seen, one is seeing your nakedness. Let me give you evidence of that. Remember in Genesis 3 and in verse 7, they covered the midsection of the body. much like jogging shorts, part of the thigh must have still been showing. And yet they were still said in verse 10 to be naked, and it wasn't until God put something on them called a tunic covering from the shoulder to the knee that their nakedness was covered. Well, let's go to the book of Exodus. And you say, well, this is Old Testament law. Yes, it's Old Testament law, but what it does is it defines for us what the thigh is. And if you don't have this passage marked in your Bible, this might be a good passage to mark as someone wants to know why is this outfit wrong, or what's wrong with some of the outfits that... You might look at this definition of what the priests were to wear. Our priests today, we all are priests, are we to wear these garments? No, that's not the point. The point is, in Exodus 28, of the thigh being equated with nakedness. Look at Exodus 28 and verse 42. This was the garment the priest was to wear. Verse 42 says, you shall make them linen trousers to cover their nakedness. Their nakedness needs to be covered. They shall reach from the waist to the thigh. Now, there are several possibilities about that. From the waist to the thigh, does that mean it begins at the waist and goes to the thigh? Not much room there. Another possibility is it includes one of those but doesn't include the other. Well, that's kind of a convoluted study. And we're going to forego that, lest I bore you with details, but I'm prepared, if you'd like to sit down and study, that construction, that Hebrew idiom, from unto, encompasses both the waist and the thigh, all of the thigh. That same construction is used in several passages. May not be referring to the body at that time, it may be referring from this city unto that city, but it includes both of those, like territory descriptions throughout the conquest. That same Hebrew idiom would be used, from unto. And it included both of the things that were mentioned. They were included in that. The point is, the priest's thigh was to be covered from his waist to his thigh. What if he put on something that covered about half of his thigh? Would that fit the description here? And you would say, no, he needs to cover his thigh because of his nakedness. My point is that Exodus 21 says that if his thigh was shown, his nakedness was seen. Let's go to another passage in the book of Isaiah. This is talking about Babylon, how God, this is figurative language, of course, how God was going to embarrass Babylon. I'm going to humiliate Babylon. And God could have just said that, I'm going to humiliate you in front of all your neighbors. That's not how he did it. He worded it in a way that wouldn't seem to fit in our modern time if you were to describe, if we had a president that described, I'm going to embarrass Iran. What are you going to do to Iran? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lift up her skirt and expose her thigh. Well, that wouldn't embarrass Iran. It doesn't embarrass women today to do that. They raise their skirts and they show their thighs. But here's what God said. Look at verse 2. Take off the skirt, uncover the thigh. Might underline thigh there. Pass through the rivers. Now verse 3, here's your key. Your nakedness shall be uncovered. You see, that agrees with what we just saw here in Genesis and in Exodus. Nakedness and the thigh were equated one with the other. And that's not the only part of nakedness. That doesn't mean if you wrap something around your thighs, you're covered your nakedness. Now you can go on. That's quite absurd. But that was part of one's nakedness. Now let's make some application. I said I would speak bluntly and plainly. Listen to me, ladies, particularly. When a man or a boy sees your thigh, he sees your nakedness. If you wear a bathing suit, he's seeing your nakedness. When you wear shorts, and your thigh is seen, at least portions of your thigh are seen, men are seeing your nakedness. Maybe a short dress. It might be one that rides above the knee when you walk or when you sit. Maybe a split that gives a peek of the thigh. It might be jeans that go from the waist all the way to dragging the ground. You've done wore off the cuff. But it has holes in the thigh where you can see right through and there's a glimpse of the thigh. You are exposing your nakedness. That's the principle. It helps us to understand. Here's the third principle. How about some simple principles that ought to help us with our dress? Divinely made clothing. Nakedness is not to be seen. Here's a point that has been missed in much of the material that is presented on modesty. Men are more visually stimulated than women. Compared to women, men are more aroused by visual stimuli. That is why pornography is more of a temptation for men than for women. Are women sometimes given in to the temptation of pornography? We talked about that last week. Some are. But not the great numbers you have with men. Why? Well, for obvious reasons. The Bible talks about that. In Matthew chapter 5, it is easy for a man to look into lust. Not right, but it's easy for him to do that. Jesus said, if a man looks upon a woman, why didn't he talk about the woman? Do women not look in lust? Sometimes they do, but not easily as men. Not as easy as men. There's some things that are addressed to women in the Bible that apply equally to man, but the woman was addressed because she's more prone to that than men. And in this case, men are more prone to this. Proverbs 6, do not lust after her beauty in your heart. Do you mean she couldn't look and lust after men? She sure could, but she's not as prone to do that as a man. That gives us some insight. Not only are men more stimulated by visual stimuli, but they are stimulated far more quickly than women. One fellow preacher described saying women are more like crockpots and men are like microwaves in that regard. Those are the facts that we're not teaching our daughters. Listen to this carefully, women, young ladies, old ladies, middle-aged ladies, whoever you are. Ladies, it doesn't take much visually to arouse a man's sexual interest in you. All he needs is a hint, a glimpse, or a peek. That's all it takes. That's all it takes. Now, before someone makes this point in your own mind, let me suggest to you that there are men with dirty minds. 2 Peter talks about that. Doesn't call them men of dirty minds. Said they have eyes full of adultery. We would describe them as dirty, filthy-minded men. What it means eyes full of adultery. Here are men who couldn't look at any woman. It doesn't matter if she was dressed from head to toe in a burlap sack. He's still going to lust because that's all he can think about. There are men with dirty minds. That's true. But that's not the man we're concerned about in our study. Not all men have dirty minds, and yet they are tempted and have temptations. There are good, godly men who try their best to be pure, who when they see sexually attractive dress, they have to fight sexual thoughts. And they'll tell you that. They'll be honest. We're not teaching that to our women. For a woman to dress in a way that is sexually attractive and then put all the blame on the man for his thoughts is very much like leaving bare wires exposed and blame the child for getting shot. You can't do that. We'll look at some passages that talk about that very principle here in just a moment. But here's a principle we need to go to. Let's talk about the word modest. I'm not going to talk a lot about that because an obvious reason I'll give in just a moment. The Bible talks about modest apparel. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9, women are to dress themselves in modest apparel. What does the word modest mean? Well, the English, in interest of time, I might just suggest to you, means to have this shy or reserved estimation of yourself. The word that is translated modest, Vine says it means orderly, well-arranged, that of dress and demeanor. Several other lexicographers would say that it means well-arranged, seemingly respectable, orderly. Same word for which we get our word cosmos, world. So what does the word modest mean? Well, the word modest, simply summarized, means to be reserved, be humble, respectable, decent, and orderly. Now, here's where we make some of our mistakes in talking about modesty. I think we drive home the word modesty, modesty, modest, 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 modest. And the word itself doesn't give any specifics. There are other principles that give our specifics. And I think the thought of the people is, quite often is, the word modest is kind of a vague, general, broad term. So no one can really figure out what's modest or not. That's why I didn't call this lesson modesty or immodesty. I want to talk about sexually attractive dress, a carefully worded thing. But this is a Bible principle, that we're to show reservation and respect. Here's another principle in 1 Timothy chapter 2, and that is the principle of shame. The women are to dress in modest apparel with shamefacedness. Other translations will say shamefastness, or the New King James uses the word propriety. What does that mean? Well, the idea of shame, it comes from a word that just simply means a sense of shame, a shamefastness that is fast rooted in your character. That's the idea of shamefastness. Fast, it's fixed, it's firm. Not fast in the sense of speed, fast in the sense it's steadfast. Here is a sense of shame that is rooted in your character. Not a superficial thing, but that's part of your character. Strong says it comes from compound word, which means literally downcast eyes or bashfulness. See, someone who is showing part of their breast, showing part of their thighs, and have a tight, form-fitting outfit on, could you say, boy, she's really shy. She's bashful. Not at all. Not at all. Here's another principle. Good judgment. Good judgment. 1 Timothy chapter 2 not only mentions the word modest, shamefastness, but mentions this word sobriety. Not a word we use every day. Various translations of that. The King James uses the word sobriety. New King James uses the word moderation. Neither of those words do we use quite often. What do they mean? All it just simply means is sound judgment, good judgment. That would curb us, as Vine describes it, that would put a constant rein on those passions and desires. Good judgment. It literally means sanctity, using saneness, self-control. Listen to me carefully. Good judgment says, ladies, don't show him what he should not see. If he doesn't need to see some part of your body, don't show it to him. Don't give him a hint. Don't give him a glimpse. Don't give him a peek. Don't show him its form. That's good judgment. That's good judgment. Now, let's talk about a second thing. What we've looked at are some simple principles that ought to govern our dress, from the divinely made clothing to the word modest, to shame, and to good judgment, to the fact that men are more easily stimulated by the visual than the women, etc. Now, let's try to establish the fact that it's possible your clothes could be sexually attractive like that of the world. You say, oh, no, that's not. Let's think about that. I ask you to give this a fair hearing. Is all I ask. It's possible that our clothes today could be sexually attractive. Let's clarify sexually attractive. Let's define some words. Sometimes people say, I don't like all the defining of words. Well, words are vehicles of thought. Any English teacher will tell you, words are vehicles of thought. If we don't understand what the word means, then we're not communicating proper thought. Let's define some words. Let's talk about the word attract. The word attract comes from the Latin ad and trahere, which means, ad meaning in the direction of, and trahere means to pull. The word attract means to draw or pull toward. This is interesting. You use this word all the time. Some of you do anyway, I know. And you may not realize this is the root from which it comes. It means to pull toward. Related words, tractor. If you have a tractor, pull something toward it. It comes from this word from which we get the word attract. It means to pull in the direction of. A tractor trailer rig, the tractor's in the front pulling. Means to pull or to draw. That's what the word means. The word attractive is not wrong within itself, but it suggests providing pleasure, arousing interest. It may not involve sexual things. It might involve people, but it arouses some interest, pulls you toward it. Having the ability to draw or to pull from this root concept of attract. So sexually attractive clothing, listen to this carefully, sexually attractive clothing is clothing that draws or pulls attention toward one's body. where the attention is sexual attention. It draws attention to sections of the body that are sexually arousing. That's sexually attractive dress. That's what we're talking about. It's talking about the kind of attire that may draw attention toward some section of the body that is sexually arousing. Now that we define that, let's talk about the fact that our clothing often sends a signal. Oftentimes, it sends a sexual signal. I want you to get that point. Our clothing sends a signal. Oftentimes, it could be sending a sexual signal, whether we recognize that or not. Whether we intend that or not. Ladies, as far as men are concerned, sexually attractive clothing has the same effect, whether that's your intent or not. Let me give you an illustration of that. Here's a man walks out of his door, and his neighbor on the one side is working in her yard in her bikini. Her intent is to be sexually attractive. He looks to the other side, and the neighbor in that yard is out working in her bikini. Her intent is not to be sexually attractive. She has no intent of doing that. She's just wanting to get some sun. Now, which one has the effect of drawing his sexual attention? It has the same effect, whether that is your intent or not. I'm trying to be blunt, and yet at the same time discreet. Ladies, you may be sending signals that you're not aware you're sending. You could be sending some signals that you're not aware you're sending. I want you to bear with some quotations from somebody that's not a preacher, that is not even, as far as I know, believe the same principles about modesty and morality that we believe. That's a person of the world. But her testimony is quite interesting. Here is a woman called, her name is Shante Feldhan, wrote a book in 2009 called The Male Factor, How Men Perceive Women's Work Behavior and the Misperceptions that Women Have About Men. And I have a number of quotations to bear with it because this is getting at the heart of what we're missing on the principle of modesty. Among the thousands of men, she said in her book, that I have interviewed, men and women, and surveyed over the years, I have found no subject more universally misunderstood than what a man thinks when he sees a woman overtly showing a good figure. She said, we're frequently told men are visual, and I realize that many women don't know what that means. According to researchers, scientists, some percent of women, perhaps as much as 25%, are as visual as men are, yet in that category, you're more likely instinctively to understand a man's reactions. But 75% of women who aren't as visual as men have very little concept, literally, of how men see them. In other words, most of the women don't have a clue of what their dress does to men. They don't have a clue about that. She tells us why. I won't read this quotation, but she set up a scenario. She wrote a novel in 2001, and in this novel, she set up a scene in her story about a man named Doug, she described, who was sitting in a business setting, listening to different professionals in the business come in and give some presentation about the business. And of those professionals, most of them were men, but one woman would cycle through giving her presentation, and she would be wearing a low-cut shirt and a tight skirt, wearing a blouse or a suit that showed off her figure in some way. And so then she interviewed a number of men so she could write her novel, saying, what kind of reaction would this man have to seeing this woman? And she said, I was amazed at the reaction. These men said, you might put in the book that they're going to have the reaction of great body. Stop it. What am I thinking? Look at her face, look at her face, look at her face. I bet she's using her curves to sell the deal, etc. And I wonder what's under that suit. She said, I was unnerved to hear those comments because these were happily married men who respected women. She said, that taught me something about men's reactions. And yet, in most instances, the women had no idea of what was really going on inside of the men around her. She goes on to say, and I won't read all of this quotation, but that men have a temptation, a wiring that presents a similar temptation that they often say they wish they could turn off. they wish it weren't there. And if a woman is dressing in a way to emphasize her body, the fact that it is not only noticed, but it begins a train of thought that more men in business wish that they did not have. They wish they could just turn that off. It creates a distraction for them. She says there is a disconnect between male and female. She said to test the difference. In men and women's perceptions in this area, I asked men what they would think if they saw a woman dressing in a way that emphasized or show off her figure in some way, such as a low-cut top or tight skirt. And I asked white-collar women who said they sometimes dress in a way, what they actually was going through, what was going through their mind. There was starkly differing results. 76% of the men felt that the women wanted the men around them to look at her body. Yet only 23% of the women actually felt that way. In other words, 3 out of 4 women said they did not, that was not what they were thinking at all. Bear with 2 more quotations from her. Said, among men who have female colleagues who don't have strict workplace uniforms, 58% say they see a female associated dressed this way once a week. Some said every day, sometimes multiple times a day. Most of the women in question undoubtedly intend merely to dress professionally and attractively, and were not aware that their attire is perceived as visually distracting. Here is what she finally said. One of the men said, in regard to the outfits that tend to trigger response in men, he said, here's what we see and here's the distraction. It's all about curves, bare skin, frankly, the sight of whatever's supposed to be covered. That is what men's eyes are drawn to. The tight outfit, the short skirt, the bra strap showing, low-cut pants in the back, where you can see the top of whatever she's wearing underneath if she leans over a bit. Any one of those things is a distraction and cleavage, he said. What did I learn from this testimony of someone out in the world? That generally women are totally unaware of how men think. There's a reason for that. Let's let a prostitute tell us why that's the case. The attire of a harlot says a lot, doesn't it? The fact that there is such a thing as the attire of a harlot. It's a Bible expression. Proverbs 7. What it says is that she knows how to be sexually attractive. We think of a harlot, we may think of the attire of a harlot as being some trashy, painted-up gal with high-heeled boots and walks the streets and looks like trash itself. That's really not the picture of Proverbs 7. It is simply has to do with clothing that draws or pulls sexual attention. Years ago, a friend of mine, Gary Henry, some of you know, known him for 30 years or better, had an opportunity to interview a prostitute. He is quick to add she was off duty. He happened to sit beside her on a bus trip in Nevada. And in Nevada, if you're not aware, in that state, all but 2 counties, prostitution is legal. And she rode down this bus trip and sat beside him. And they began to exchange, well, what do you do for a living? Well, he at the time was in the printing business, and I do thus and so. And out of curiosity and courtesy, he said, what do you do? And she said, I work through the week at a certain place, but on weekends I work at this brothel on commission. Well, he asked her, are you aware of Proverbs 7:10, the passage in the Bible that talks about the attire of a harlot? She said, yes, I'm aware of that. I've heard of that. And he asked her, could you explain that to me? Now, this was interesting. She said, I sure can. And so she explained it to him. Here's what the attire of a harlot is. This is an interview with a prostitute. She said, this is how you draw attention to certain parts of your body. And she had 5 ways of doing that. I might add that she said that she working in a brothel means that men come in and have to pick out among the women they want, and so you are competitive with other women to draw the attention to yourself. And so she said, I know how to do that. Here's the 5 ways you do that, she said. You reveal it. She said, that's the most least effective. You just show your body off. Another way is you conceal it and reveal everything else, like a bikini. A third way is you reveal just a little bit of it. Give a hint, a preview, or a glimpse. And a fourth way is you cover it tightly and you show the form. And she said the fifth way is you cover it thinly. And she says that is the most provocative. Gary's response to her was, "You seem to know a good bit about men." And her response was, "It's my business to know. I need to know." He asked, "Well, why is it that religious women often don't know as much about men as you seem to know? Women who want to avoid the kind of thing you're involved in and who want to be modest and decent, why do they not know as much as you seem to know?" And her reaction was this. Listen to this carefully. Fathers and mothers particularly. Because they have never been taught about men by anyone other than their mothers, who often know very little themselves. Women who know how a man thinks are those who have been taught by a man. She said, "I know how men think. I know how to dress to get their attention." So let's go back to her five ways. Could it be that some of our clothing fits what this prostitute says, "I use myself"? She says, one of the things, ways you draw sexual attention, we're talking about sexually attractive clothing. Listen to me, young ladies. I ask you to give me a fair hearing. Middle-aged ladies, older ladies. One of the ways she says you do that is you reveal it. You show more skin. And perhaps the more that is shown, the more attractive you become in some cases. You give them a look at your thighs. You don't have to show the whole thing. That might not be as attractive as just giving them a shot of it, a little glimpse of it, a peek of it. Let them see your thighs. Give them a look at your breast, just part of it. Let them see your midriff, even if it's just accidentally when you bend or when you stoop or when you walk and your shirt rides up. Show them your back or your shoulders. And she said, that's one way you do that. A second way of doing that is you conceal it and reveal everything else. And we've already mentioned swimsuits, especially the bikini would do that. And the design of that is it draws attention to what remains covered. But she said also a way to do that is you reveal just a little bit of it. Well, how's that done? Well, you give them a glimpse of the thigh. You don't have to wear a bikini or one-piece bathing suit to show them your thigh. You can show them by just giving them a glimpse of that. You might wear a dress or a skirt that's not real short, not a mini skirt. That would be obnoxious. You wouldn't want to do that. You wouldn't want to be caught in a mini skirt. But you might wear a skirt that's not real short, but it gives them a hint of the thigh. Gives them a good introduction to the thigh. They're seeing your nakedness. It might be jeans that play peekaboo with a low back. Does it ever dawn on us that when you're standing still and looking in a mirror and that everything is just in place, that when you walk, that clothes move? Jeans ride down and tops ride up. Cleavage, it gives a preview of the breast, is revealing just a little bit of it. That's what a prostitute, a harlot, says. This is part of what attire of a harlot is. You don't have to be painted up like a trashy gal that walks the streets. You don't have to do that to be of the attire of a harlot. She said you cover it tightly. One-piece bathing suits do that, but also tight jeans, tight pants. Draw attention. Ask a man. Tops that reveal the shape of the breast, where you have no doubt what she has. Snug fits of the dress or the skirt over the backside. Do I have to be more graphic? Draw attention to that part of the body, where lines of the undergarment are clearly marked and seen. She goes on to say that you cover it thinly. Sometimes a white top, thin top, reveal the undergarment. Thin pants, again, underline, outline the underwear garment. Sometimes material so thin that it clings to the body. By the way, those passages of 1 Timothy 2 and 2 Peter that talk so much about the immodest garments that were expensive, wasn't the cost. It was the fine silk of which it was made that made it mark out the form of the body. Check Clement of Alexandria and see what he said about that. Now let's mention another thing. We're still trying to establish it's possible our clothing could be sexually attractive. Revealing clothing sometimes can be more sexually attractive than complete nudity. This quotation has circulated among brethren for many, many years. In this book called Of Love and Lust, Theodore Reich said, an astonishing great number of men are of the opinion that women are more attractive partly dressed than nude. Well, I'll end that quotation there in interest of time. But his point is, surveys would show that to be the case. That if given a choice, they're more easily aroused by the former than the latter. It is possible, ladies, that your clothing could be sexually attractive, and that's not your intent. That's not what you want. Now, let's spend just a few moments talking about objection, and the lesson will be yours. What are some objections people make? I want to mention three. There are more than that that people offer, but I want to mention three with you. Here's the first. In response to this kind of thing, someone is sure to say, well, if somebody thinks something about my clothes, that's their problem. My dress is a little tight, and some guy looks at me, and he has some thoughts that I didn't intend for him to have. That's his problem. That's not mine. Well, their problem is secondary to the thing we're addressing. The problem we're addressing, the main problem we're addressing is that parts of your body, including your thigh, your form, and your cleavage, should not be shown to any man except your mate. That's the point we're making. One who causes another to stumble or initiates the process bears some guilt in that regard. Let's look at a couple of passages. I said, promised you earlier, we'd come to this principle. Remember the illustration we had of the man looking at a woman and she blames him for it? It's like the leaving the wires exposed and blaming the child. Remember that? I said we'd come to a passage. Well, this is it. Let's look at Luke 17. In Luke 17, Jesus talks about offenses. And offenses have to do, look at the definition, and even your footnote will say, cause to sin. It means you lead someone else to sin. It's not that someone is offended and doesn't like it. You don't offend me because I don't like your garment. I may not like the color of it if I could see it. But that's not offensive if it causes me to sin. That's the point of Luke 17. That it is impossible that no offenses should come, but woe to him through whom they do come. If you cause me to sin, do I give an account for that? You bet. But is it possible you could lead me to sin? Certainly so. Certainly so. Luke 17 says you bear some guilt in that. Well, let's go to the Old Testament for one passage before we leave that point and look at another. Let's look at 1 Kings, if you will. The 21st chapter and in verse 25. Here is the case where someone did wrong, but someone helped in the matter. Look at verse 25. Ahab sold himself to do wickedness in the sight of the Lord because Jezebel, his wife, stirred him up. Did he do wrong? Yes. Was she innocent? You bet not. She stirred him up. What's the point, ladies? Well, the point is, a man looks at you and he has sexual thoughts. You cannot merely say, well, that's his problem. Yes, it is his problem. He's got a problem, all right. But you're not innocent in that if you've encouraged that by the way that you dress. Here's a second objection. You know what? You can't know where to draw the line. And that's why I think sometimes we say, we need to dress modest. That's it, and let's go on. How do you define modest? No one can really know where to draw the line. Well, there's certainly some areas of judgment. No one would deny that. But listen to this carefully. If you can say that we can't draw the line, that puts us in a real strange position here. You think about that. And I've had brethren to tell me that, you know what, you just, there's no way to know where to draw the line. If that's the case, if we can't know where to draw the line, then let's let the length of the dress or the skirt get shorter than shorter than shorter. If not, why not? If you couldn't draw it at the knee, then would mid-thigh be okay? Okay. Why not all the way up to the thigh? Instead of a mini skirt this long, how not have a skirt about this long? Would that be okay? We can't know where to draw the line, you see. See the absurdity of that? And then let's let the top get lower and lower and lower until finally the top and the bottom meet somewhere. If not, why not? That puts us in a real strange position to say that we don't know where to draw the line. And if you do draw a line, and you will, those who say you don't know where to draw the line or we can't know where to draw the line, they draw a line. There'll be a point at which they say, that's it. It will be absolutely arbitrary on their part. Absolutely arbitrary. And so you start up and say, well, no, that's not immodest, that's not immodest. At finally some point they say, whoa, that's far enough. That's as far as it can come up. And the same thing with the top coming down. There's a point at which they say, oh, no, that's where. It will be absolutely arbitrary. They will not point to a Bible principle. I'll point to a Bible principle. Can you? Sure you can. We can point to Bible principles. We can draw the line. God drew a line from the shoulder to the knee, Genesis 3 and verse 21. That's divinely made clothing. That's the best kind. That's the best kind. I know it was right. And harmonizing with that is the fact that the thighs were equated with nakedness. I can draw a line that if the thighs are showing at all, that's nakedness. It's a Bible principle. And I can draw the line that if it is anyway sexually attractive, it's wrong. Here's the final one. We hear this a lot sometimes. It's really hard to find modest clothes. I've searched among brethren and material that other preachers have presented on this question, and every one of them, nearly, that I come across, has a section of objections, and this is in every one of them. It's really hard to find modest clothes. I agree with you, preacher. We need to dress modest, but I tell you what, the reason I'm wearing this outfit and I wear these tight clothes, it's just really hard to find modest clothes. What do you think about that a minute? Hard, yes, but not impossible. If it could not be found, then what we're saying is we cannot conform to the will of God. We can't conform to the will of God. The way of the Lord's hard sometimes. Sometimes it's hard. And it's not easy. Let me illustrate that for a moment. Let's just do some supposing for a moment. Let's suppose the Bible teaches us that in order to be identified with God's people, that you were required to wear an orange pair of coveralls. They're ugly. They're tacky. They're not in style. That's not my color. Can you think of 101 reasons you shouldn't wear them? What would you do? What would you do? Would you say, I'll tell you what, orange coveralls in my size are hard to find. That's why I'm wearing jeans and a top. I know to be with God's people, I need to wear orange coveralls, but they're just hard to find. That's why I wear jeans and a top. Would you say that? Would you rather look like the world? And if the Bible required that, would you rather put these on and be identified with God's people as dorky as you look than to be identified with the world? Would it be worth the sacrifice, giving up all your other clothes? Would you make sure yours were orange? Would you say, yeah, I can't find orange coveralls? You know what? If that were required, would it not require some sacrifice that I may have to find some coveralls that have to be altered a little bit? Buy some white ones and dye them orange. Wouldn't that be a solution? And if we can't find coveralls that are orange, Could we not find somebody somewhere to make us some orange coveralls? I think I could somewhere. Certainly somebody would sew some orange coveralls somewhere. And in worst case scenario, would it be so bad for me to learn how to make some of those? As crude as they'd be, because I want to conform to God's will. And if we can see it with orange coveralls, why can't we see it with the principles we've been talking about? We need to come out from the world and be separate, 2 Corinthians chapter 6. What have we seen? I ask you to give a fair hearing, and I know we've gone a while. But this material is better presented in one session than to divide it up and many not hear the other part. Simple principles for dress, possible that our clothing could be sexually attractive, and the objections. Could you say one is trying not to be sexually attractive when one of these three things happens? Could you look at a lady, a woman, and say that woman is working hard as she can, striving to be the godly woman she's should be. She's trying every way possible not to be sexually attractive. When, if an additional half inch of skin were to be shown, her nakedness would be exposed. When she dresses that close to the line, that let's just hope she doesn't move, she doesn't bend, that the wind doesn't blow, because if it were to, her nakedness would be shown. Could you say she's really trying hard not to be sexually attractive? Could you say that when, if she moved or she would bend or sat, that she's showing her nakedness? And when she sits, she has to plug and pull and tug and try to stretch that dress or skirt to finally cover all of her nakedness? Hold the split together. And could you say she's really working hard at being the woman and not trying to be sexually attractive when, if the outfit were even a quarter inch tighter, she may not be able to get back out of that? You clearly show her form. Could we say that? May God help us to give a fair hearing to the material that you've been exposed to this morning. Sexually attractive dress. There may be one more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God?